It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media. Well, today it's Move a Little, Lose a Lot. New neat science reveals how to be thinner, happier, and smarter. Well, that's the book by our guest, Dr. James Levine. And frankly, it's the kind of book I usually ignore as hype. But this baby has 15 years of research at the Mayo Clinic behind it, and Dr. Levine, one of those people who could possibly change the world. In the no time, no spare dollars department, we've got a great fast treat. Homemade, adult-approved popsicles. No special equipment required. Food & Wine magazine's wine man, Ray Isle, tries to convert me to Chardonnays. And as always in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine.
Lynn, I have a farmer's parable for you, and this is it. Do you know how to tell the difference between Holstein milk and Jersey milk? That's from the two different kinds of cows. Well, here's what you do. You pour a Holstein's milk into one pail and a Jersey's milk into another pail, and then put a silver dollar in the bottom of each pail. You can see the silver dollar in each pail, even though the Holstein's milk is like maybe four or five times as much as the Jersey's. That's because Holstein's milk is thin and Jersey milk is so thick and so creamy and so delicious that it makes great, great ice cream.
Michael loves cow trivia.
Well, and Jane, I have to say, has always been a big fan of Elsie the cow, who was herself the best known Jersey
yes,
ever.
Yes, and my dog's name is Elmer, after Elmer the bull.
I remember.
But anyway,
yes.
We never understood the fine points between Holstein's and Jersey's. And if you have ice cream made from a Jersey cow, what can I say? You'll never go back. I mean, it is at Woodside Farm in, and I can never say the name of the town correctly, Michael. Can you say it?
No, probably not. Hockessin, Delaware. Let's just call it that.
Hockessin, Delaware. It's a working Jersey cow farm, and the people who run it make all of their ice cream from their little herd of Jerseys. And truly, I have never tasted, and this is going out on a limb, but I will say this is the best ice cream I've ever tasted
really?
In my entire life. Yeah, really, really.
Well, the people that run this place are really into the happiness of their cows. I mean, they move them from field to field, so the grass is always nice and green and fresh, and they're getting a lot of clover, and they're really into their cows being happy, which they say produces the best milk. In fact, they started this herd in the 1990s, even though the farm is literally centuries old, mm-hmm. and they still have the original cows that they started the herd with, Abby and Melissa, who, of course, are now, like, way too old to give milk.
Now, this is interesting, because we did an interview with someone who had done research that evidently showed that cows that were called by their names gave more milk.
So I believe it.
The happiness thing may well end up in the cone you're eating. I mean,
well, Abby and Melissa certainly left a legacy, and these are the prettiest, happiest, healthiest cows that I have ever seen. I mean, they live on fields of clover, and, you know, each one has a name, and they're groomed, and they're petted, and the ice cream, which you can get there filled with, you know, every kind of mix in and flavor.
Right,
and
right.
Even some goofy stuff, which personally I don't see the need for, like Lucky Charm cereal mixed into it. If you just get the plain cream or
vanilla,
I don't know, vanilla
plain
cream.
Vanilla is the greatest.
It is the best thing you have ever tasted and the richest. I do have to say it makes all other super duper premium ice creams taste like skim milk.
This place sounds like heaven.
It is.
Hey, guys, thank you.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye-bye, Lynn.
Well, get up, you cows, and I get them on the move. The rotors are swinging like water in balloons. I go up to the barn, and I know their place with the lead one first, and I close the gate. Bring the cart around, give them all some feed. They lick their nose, flap theirs at me. I put on the machine, and I feel so good. I let down their milk like a good cow should. Getting in the cows, show them in the barn. Put them in the stands and turn the radio on. Milk them all dry, send them out again. Wait a month on the dairy for the check to come in. A month on the dairy for the check to come in.
Well, Jane and Michael Stern are authors of 500 Things to Eat Before It's Too Late. Now, you know the Sterns are here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. We had a recent experience with truth and advertising. You buy fish in the supermarket and it's labeled red snapper, let's say. But how do we know that it's really red snapper? Well, we went to Stephen Palumbi's lab. Now, he's professor of marine sciences and a senior fellow at the Stanford Institute for the Environment. Stephen showed me the only surefire way that we can know what it says on the label actually is what's in the package. It's a little DNA sleuthing. The Discovery Channel has got the video on their website. See what we found out by going to our website, splendidtable.org. You're going to find a link there. And while you're visiting, be sure to also check out all of our other opportunities. Our weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, our podcasts, info on our book, How to Eat Supper, and our latest fun and games, our Gastrosexual of the Month competition. It's all there, splendidtable.org. One of the things I like about starting to make your own food is how one day you realize that you don't have to buy all kinds of stuff. You can make them easily. Well, this is Karen Solomon's take on all kinds of treats, from bacon to candy to mustard. She calls herself a veteran culinary tinkerer, and her latest bit of tinkering is jam it, pickle it, cure it, and other culinary projects. Karen, welcome.
Thank you, Lynn.
Karen, I want to talk frozen desserts, as in what can you do without an ice cream maker?
You can do a tremendous amount without an ice cream maker. In fact, I would even say don't buy an ice cream maker because they just take up far too much room in the kitchen when they're not in use. You can get fancy schmancy and buy yourself some nice popsicle molds, or you could even just go extremely basic and go with the classic ice cube tray, saran wrap, toothpicks, you know, and have a wonderful time.
So what kinds of things?
You can make fruit-based confections that have some nice flavor extract in them. The watermelon pops, for example, have some just a little hint of orange oil or extract and a little hint of mint oil or extract. And that's really nice. It's really refreshing. I'm also a big fan of the Arnold Palmer pops, which, you know, the classic drink of lemonade mixed with iced tea. Frozen in a couple of layers is it's a lot of fun and extremely refreshing.
So we're talking dessert on a stick, basically, right?
That's right. That's right. And in my opinion, nothing is more elegant than at the end of a dinner party, you go to your freezer, you hand everyone their adorable retro frozen pop, and you go to town.
Yeah.
And then you can also, if you know, icy and fruity is not your thing, you can also go the creamy route. I have some nice coconut cream pops with coconut milk, evaporated milk, and, of course, flaked coconut.
Ooh.
And it's really just, like, tender and chewy. And it's really, you know, it's definitely on the heavier side. It's not like a light, refreshing fruit. But that's really nice. And, of course, my take on the classic fudge pop, which is insanely dense, insanely fudgy. And they go really well together, too.
So how do you do the fudge pop?
The fudge pop, you start out with some cocoa powder, which I actually prefer. A lot of recipes start with melted chocolate. And I know this logically, this doesn't make any sense, but I swear that the cocoa powder is just more chocolatey than chocolate itself. Go figure. And with that, I combine it with some evaporated milk and some corn syrup to get the sweetness in there, and vanilla extract, and then finish it with just a little butter. And then, you know, you let it cool, and you pour it into your mold and freeze it. Or, in fact, if you refrigerate it, It's also a fairly dense, like pudding kind of mousse thing that you could eat with a spoon as well. Or in winter, you can also drink it hot, and it's a fantastically dense hot chocolate. It's really nice.
With the butter in it. That's an interesting idea.
With the butter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, I would imagine that any of these could become a granita if you threw them in a food processor. Right?
Oh, absolutely. You can throw them in the freezer in like a square baking dish.
Right.
And I particularly like the granita for the icy, fruity ones as opposed to the creamy ones. And you just go at it with a fork every 30 minutes, you know, scrapey scrape. And, and then you can I like to serve it in a beautiful glass, like either a wine glass or a martini glass, you know, something like that at the end of a meal, or a palate cleanser if you want to be insanely fancy. And it's really quite easy. I mean, you just, you know, make your favorite popsicle recipe and then just, you know, break it into shards.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So and you can do this with any pureed fruit. You'd make it in a blender, right?
A blender or food processor, either one.
Well, it's a step up from the bomb pop. Karen, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Karen Solomon's book is Jam It, Pickle It, Cure It, and Other Culinary Projects. Now, she left us with her recipe for chocolate fudge pops. You can find it on the website, splendidtable.org. Popsicle. I've just discovered something. You know how the roll of aluminum foil often ends up dropping out of the box and rolling all over the place? Getting it back into the box so it's usable is almost impossible. Well, take a look at the side of the box. A friend of a friend discovered this by accident. On the side of the aluminum foil box, it says, "Press here to lock end." It's a tab to lock in the roll. And the same thing is on a lot of plastic wrap boxes, too. Now, if you've known this forever, please don't tell me, because I feel foolish enough already. Coming up, how to be thinner, smarter, and happier without snake oil, and Chardonnays for people who hate Chardonnay. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Want to see the future? Look around where you work. In the future, your desk would be a slow-rolling treadmill with a computer mounted on it. The gym would be crossed off your calendar in favor of cooking with friends who always make you laugh, and there would be a reminder to pace while you're on the phone. All this comes from a decade of detailed obesity research at Mayo Clinic and the imagination of Dr. James Levine. He's director of the NEAT Center at Mayo Clinic. NEAT translates as non-exercise activity thermogenesis. Now, in English, that means the small day-to-day movements we've lost over the past century. Well, we visited him at his office in Mayo, and no surprise, not a chair in sight, but there was the treadmill, a 10-year-old Sears model patched with duct tape. And as I expected, Dr. Levine is lean. I didn't expect exuberant.
We're talking to each other across a treadmill.
Please go ahead. Lynn, we're to jump up.
Can I try this? Here we go. Hey, this is amazing. This isn't too fast.
Isn't it great?
How fast am I going?
You're going exactly at 1 mile an hour. And again, just to give you a feel, you're burning about 100 to 140 extra calories an hour as you're doing this.
You realize I'm breaking that down too, and how many bites of mashed potatoes tonight. You understand that. This is the original model, office model, and this is your desk, right?
This is the very, very first model ever of the walking treadmill desk, and you can see the pieces of tape.
Yes,
it's together.
Put together with duct tape and glue. Yes,
wires and bolts hanging off it.
You can work this way. I mean, doesn't your concentration change? Because I'm trying to remember to walk,
and type at the same time. And doesn't this get in the way of the thinking and the creative process?
Well, actually, just there to your left, a colleague of mine from the University of Minnesota sent me a very interesting paper that actually demonstrates that people have fewer sick days, they feel better, they feel sharper. And we've just got some papers coming out demonstrating that people actually type faster, they type more accurately when they get the hang of it.
Really?
And they don't sleep at 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Huh.
Here's a way of curing the afternoon dip.
So can you take me to the other lab?
Let's rock and roll.
Okay.
Forward, troops.
Forward, yes.
Dr. Levine led us, at practically a trot, the man moves like a flash, from his office through the halls of the Mayo Clinic to the NEAT Center.
In the laboratories where we actually develop all of the tools we use, I mean, literally now across the country, and obviously sort of, you know, beyond the realms of the United States.
So this is the NEAT Center, and this is where the
magic occurs.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Okay, I'm ready.
I'm with you.
Now, it's a working lab. Every surface has gizmos, gadgets, or computers, and there is an area where it looks like a high school wood shop. Incongruous until I realize it's part of building a prototype treadmill desk. James enthusiastically introduces us to each and every person who's working that day. There are researchers studying brain activity and gene sequences in one corner of the room, and a technology specialist actually building equipment in another.
I'm going to lean here against one of our prototype desks that we're making now for the hundreds and hundreds of people who want one. So these are very inexpensive desk units, very inexpensive treadmill units that we're literally building so that regular office workers across the United States can activate their NEAT.
Now, NEAT again, describe it to me.
So NEAT is the scientific term, non-exercise activity thermogenesis. It is all of those calories, all of those things we do moving around day to day.
Not going to the gym.
Not going to the gym and not lying in bed and not sitting down on the sofa watching TV. It is all those kind of fun, dynamic things that bring us alive. And really what's going on is the body over about 1 million years evolved to walk. That is how we're designed. And what's happened over about the last century is we've become tied or almost chained to the chair. And so this has affected the body not only in terms of calorie burning, mm-hmm. but also in terms of our intellectual capacity and our mood, in that sort of sense of well-being. And it's the sort of joie de vivre that we all sort of, we want to be peppy and upbeat, and that's sort of dissolved away. And the deep science that's sort of going on in the laboratory is demonstrating again and again that if you can find the means of having people thread this NEAT throughout their day, all of these things from muscle to brain, even to people's personal intimacy drives and their happiness, all improve. And what we're finding is that the more of that you do, the more NEAT occurs as a consequence. So people get healthier and happier and then become healthier and happier still.
James, has the 100 years of all of this idleness, so to speak, caused any genetic changes in how we're built?
It's almost the other way around. Is our DNA predated any of these changes? And so what has actually happened is our DNA set us up to respond to the new chair-based environment differently. Some people were going to always remain up and moving and have that zip and the zap. Mm-hmm. And we're never going to gain weight, which explains why about a third of the population hasn't gained weight. But everyone else has the genes for storing excess fuel and gaining additional body fat. And so they have gained all these additional pounds and had the health consequences of obesity.
And that's the business about the feast and the famine.
That is exactly right. You can imagine over 1 million years that we were designed to always be looking for opportunities for food. And when food became available in excess, we stored those extra calories in our body fat. And in fact, some of our patients who are sort of desperately suffering and in pain with their obesity are storing 3 months of groceries on their body. And what is absolutely tragic about this, is that this is a natural way for the body to operate. It's a natural thing for the body to store these excess calories. And yet my patients with obesity are suffering 5 times an hour with this problem. They are thinking about it. They're worrying about it. They're feeling ostracized in society about it. People feel absolutely awful carrying the extra weight. And yet, as we're saying, this is really a symptom of how the body is built.
You know, there are many people who talk to people with weight problems and you realize they've never been there.
Right.
And it's not that they're unfeeling or not understanding, but there's a real joy to eating that some people experience and others don't.
And also, I think even beyond that, it's a primal pleasure, right?
Mm-hmm.
Every time we put something in our mouths, how wonderful it feels, how fun it is to cook something up and eat it. And so the idea, our relationship with food is very, very important. And I've spent 15, 20 years now in clinics seeing patients who are explaining the strange paradox that they're enjoying something so fundamental to life, and yet on the other hand have to find the means of adjusting it mm-hmm. so as to live mm-hmm. more healthily. And it's a paradox, but it's a really important one. If we were having really active lifestyles where we were burning thousands and thousands of calories a day, it would no longer be relevant. But in the modern world, we have to find that balance between really high-quality, beautiful food that we've made ourselves, we're going out to eat, or whatever it may be,
mm-hmm.
and our health. Because unless we have health, we can't enjoy it.
James, thank you.
My pleasure. Anytime.
Dr. James Levine is an authority on preventing and treating the global obesity epidemic. He's director of the NEAT Center at Mayo Clinic, and yes, he is as energetic as he sounds. His latest book is Move a Little, Lose a Lot. Now, for more information, go to the website, splendidtable.org. Prejudice is dangerous. I've got a problem with Chardonnay, but I suspect Ray Isle can help me out. Ray is executive wine editor of Food & Wine magazine, and he's constantly tasting and researching wines. Ray, welcome back.
It's great to be back, Lynn. Thanks.
So, Ray, here's my prejudice. I don't like Chardonnays. I used to like Chardonnays, but I don't anymore. So is it me or is it the wine?
I think it's the wine, honestly. I think Chardonnay has changed at one point. They sort of headed towards the what I think of as the being sat on by an elephant form of Chardonnay, which oddly enough had its fans for quite a while, but is starting to lose ground. And that's that big, ripe, rich, buttery, super oaky, galumphin Chardonnay. And I think it's, you know, I do think that people were okay with it for a while and are starting to move back away from it, which is pretty exciting, actually.
But what caused that? Was it this oak business of oak barrels?
Well, oak barrels, and particularly using a lot of new oak barrels. Barrels, as you use them over time, gradually impart less oak. But there was a fad, I guess you'd say, for Chardonnay that had a tremendous amount of oak and also malolactic fermentation, which makes it very buttery and rich. I mean, I think of it as kind of, you know, in the 90s, this is where this was. It's kind of Clinton-era Chardonnay. You know, it's kind of cheeseburger-eaten, hug you, make you happy, kind of be a little bit lugubrious. And now we're in Obama-era Chardonnay, which is the kind of, you know, Prius-driving, future-envisioning, lean and mean Chardonnay.
Well, I mean, I remember the marketing, which was really offensive at one point. It was wine women could drink.
Yes,
I mean,
who knew?
We never drank wine before this.
It's the marketing has always been kind of crazy with wine.
What was the classic way that Chardonnay was made?
Well, Chardonnay classically, I mean, the great Chardonnay region in Europe is Burgundy. White Burgundy is all Chardonnay. And what you had was you had some use of oak, but not necessarily 100% new barrels. And additionally, you're looking at a region that's fairly cool. So alcohol levels weren't as high as what you tend to get in, let's say, Australia, you know, the U.S., California. So it's almost as if we took what had been the traditional Chardonnay style and then just turned up the volume all the way and kind of blew out the speakers, you know. I mean, I honestly think that people here seem to like bigger styles of things. And we also, as a growing wine culture, people tend to like really powerful flavors as they first get into something.
Yeah.
And then subtlety becomes more valuable. And I think that's what's happening with wine in America right now. We've kind of gone past our baby steps of tasting and are, you know, more interested in subtlety than we used to be. There's this trend towards unoaked, really crisp, light, bright, zesty Chardonnays, which you know, tend to be a little bit less high in alcohol and also just don't have that oak slather all over them.
What about pricing? Because Chardonnays used to, I mean, they're priced through the roof.
Well, the prices were going up. And you know, partly that supply and demand. Chardonnay still is the most popular wine grape in America. And mm-hmm. so, you know, people want it, so you pay more for it. But some of these unoaked Chardonnays are great deals. Particularly, I mean, you can get a lot of good wine for under $15.
Ooh.
Yeah. Right now, that seems like a very good thing.
Yes, exactly.
So the case in point, one of the ones I like is the 2008 Cusino Macul Estate Chardonnay, which is from Chile. It doesn't actually say unoaked on the label, but it is in fact done in stainless steel tanks, and that's, you know, it's suggested retail is about $11, and that means realistically you're going to see it for under 10 in a lot of stores. And it's, you know, it's clear, crisp, sort of apple melon kind of flavors. It's just a great deal for, you know, a $10 Chardonnay. Another one I like a lot from South Africa actually is the 2008 Brampton unoaked Chardonnay, and that's. It's kind of reminds me of Bosque pears, those crisp, you know, crunchy pears.
Oh, yeah,
pears,
yeah.
With a little tangerine thrown in. And my technical tasting note on it, I look back at my notes, was yum with an exclamation point. And that's another, you know, suggested retail is 11, so you'll find it for less than that.
Under $10, this is good stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so if you were to go to a higher price point, what would really be worth the money?
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, you don't even have to go terribly high to get something really terrific. But one of my favorites, and one of the ones that started this trend in the U.S. towards unoaked Chardonnay is Chehalem is a winery in Oregon's Willamette Valley. And they make a wine called Enox, I-N-O-X, which is a kind of borrow from the French term for stainless steel. And that's, you know, suggested if you buy it from the winery, it's about 19. You may be able to find it for 17 or something. But it's lovely sort of spicy melon pear flavors. And what I think of as a tongue-tingling texture, I mean, it really brings your tongue to life instead of sitting on it like an elephant. you know, but it's one of the models of the form, and it's a really wonderful wine, and it should be findable. It's relatively widely distributed.
Huh. Well, Ray, thank you. It's redeemed for me now.
I hope so. You know, go out and try these. I think you'll be a convert, you know. The new Chardonnay era is upon us.
I shall be eternally grateful. Ray Isle is executive wine editor for Food & Wine magazine. Now, you can find his unoaked Chardonnay picks and a dish to go with them, Siracusa Market pasta, really nice at this time of year. It's all on the website, splendidtable.org. Call someone a poet might be too narrow a term to tell all one person can express. Yet to be a poet can be all a human can express. Well, for the record, Thomas Sayers Ellis is a poet, is a teacher of writing at Sarah Lawrence College, is a performer of ideas, and a photographer. The latest book of poetry he's done is The Maverick Room. Thomas, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
You know, the thing I've always wondered is, do you think that you teach?
Correct.
Are there people that have a poetic leaning? It's innate to them. And there are people who just, that's not their way of functioning?
Yeah, I think that's true. But I think that we've all been given the tools, the apparatus. I think that the human vessel, the senses, right, when aligned with the technical devices can make everyone about a 5. But some people, some pores are open, some pores are closed. People mm-hmm. feel and think differently. But I think making things is the key, which is the great thing about cooking and food. Making things, to be alone and singular in that place that's so open, makes you poetic in that way.
You've written a poem for us.
I have, yes.
Could you read it?
I will. Godzilla's avocado. Tonight, Prophet is helping Nani make creatures. The term she cooked up for mussels. I am Nani, her fake baby daddy. The one she got her style from, not her soft and buttery bottom lip. That came from Mommy. Nannies see things differently. Waffles, brown skin. Lady Liberty making us all healthy, holding up her green flame of asparagus. Prophet's a bean eater. A yummy kingpin critter. Run, Edamame, run. The same sun that rises in orange juice sets in mac and cheese. From a lumpy russet swirling in a cosmos of miso, colors mash into casserole. Kids love kitchens. The sushi chef re-ending monsters with embassy precision. Life's raw rolls, ready to unravel the difficult answers we wrap in seaweed. Love is when two people like the same food and the same toys. But war is when lots of people dress up like salads and eat each other. Messy imagination. All meals need metaphors. Poems, cutting boards. An artichoke's heart does not pump ketchup. It pumps pesto. Oily, olive, clots of guacamole. Prophet is learning to grow things, including time, real time, some sense of the vitamins of radiance. The seedling on the windowsill, slow to trust sun. Kids love nature. Things smaller than them, like mushrooms cooked into clouds. Radiation, fooling time, rushing food hurts the body. Pesticides are a big deal. Poor bees. The microwaves hives fear. Our silver age of dining.
What were you thinking when you were writing that?
Oh, I was thinking too many things, so many things, and how to control all those things. And I was also thinking how to make a thing that was more cinematic than linear, something that would perhaps express the messiness of making a meal or being in a kitchen, and also the creative process.
It all comes through. You can see it, you can hear it, and you can feel it. Thomas, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Thomas Sayers Ellis' latest book of poetry is The Maverick Room. Okay, it is time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what is the latest celebratory confection to rival the wedding cake? Well, we're going to be back in a moment with that answer, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what is the latest celebratory confection to rival the wedding cake? Well, it's sort of the balance. It's the divorce cake. A Florida newspaper reported that a baker in Fort Lauderdale, in a moment of brilliance, created the divorce cake. So what's a divorce cake? Well, think of it as a cleansing moment, a last bit of spite, and for those with a twisted sense of humor, funny. The baker, Beatrice Otero, has quite a variety, from a straightforward broken heart to the traditional tiered wedding cake, and on top is the usual bride and groom, except the groom is covered in blood and is headless, and the bride is happily coddling his head in her arms. A more elaborate one has a furious bride dragging her man to the trash cans, all depicted in scary 3D realism with "Take out the garbage" scribed over the frosting. The lines are open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. anything goes. Okay, let's see. We have got Sandy on the line from Los Angeles. Hey, Sandy, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I have a new pizza oven.
Oh?
And I want to play with it, and so does everybody else.
Is this one of those wood-fired deals?
Well, this one is the smallest one, so it's just gas. What I'm really kind of looking for is ideas that can go right from the oven to the table. Maybe appetizers or hors d'oeuvres, things that can kind of get a party rolling that can go right from the oven to the table.
The kind of thing I like to do when I'm doing something from the oven to the table and it's for, you know, hors d'oeuvre or to just have people nibbling is the kind of stuff that I don't have to do a lot of work once it's out of the oven.
Exactly.
And I don't want to do a lot of work once it's going into the oven.
Exactly. And especially with hors d'oeuvres because, you know, it's like last minute and you've always got other stuff you have to do.
Right.
So if they can kind of put that together and play with it, then...
Yeah, exactly. Well, now here's a couple of thoughts and they may, or, I mean, it may or may not appeal to you. I don't think people get the idea that a roasted vegetable on a toothpick or even grabbed with your fingers is great finger food. And if you take something like carrots, which you can cut on different angles, you know, so that the carrot is about one bite or two, but it's sort of cut on the slant, it looks really cool. Toss that with olive oil, toss that with ground cumin, toss that with some hot chili. Roast it in your oven. Take it out, just stick toothpicks in that thing, pile them on a platter, and squeeze fresh lemon juice over that. Now, obviously, you've got the salt and the pepper on it. And put some wedges of lemon around the plate, just to, you know, as a suggestion. Stick a handful of fresh coriander on that plate and just let everybody go to town.
And just let them dip in that.
That's right. And you don't need a dip. You don't need anything. It is just so great. Those carrots will get browned. They'll get that incredible sweetness. You could do the same thing with chunks of potato, but you could change those seasonings anywhere you want. The idea being a hard vegetable is something that's going to keep holding its shape. If you try zucchini, it's going to fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
So there's one idea.
Mm-hmm.
And you can take all kinds of exotic seasonings and do that.
Okay.
Another thing that I love to do for guests is I make a pie crust. And I bake it the day ahead. I roll it out super thin and I put it on a big greased pizza pan.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like a 14 or 16 inch thing.
You mean just like a flat,
yeah,
flat pan, not a pie plate?
Not a pie plate. I want it to be really, really big. I may roll the edges over just a tad.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And then I get my oven super hot, 450, somewhere around there.
Mm-hmm.
I sprinkle it with cheese, a couple of kinds of cheese, usually something gooey and sticky like mozzarella, usually something then very nutty like Gruyere or Parmigiano. Even a great aged cheddar is fabulous with this idea. And then what goes on it are, at this time of year, you do a handful of spring greens.
Oh, yeah.
And you might do thin slices of apple.
Oh,
what the other thing you might do, if you've got thin-skinned lemons, paper-thin slices of those. Then you throw some seasonings on, fresh rosemary, okay? Then you throw some olive oil on there, and then you throw some, well, a little bit of vinegar. Not a lot. And then you bake that really fast, really hot. Serve it at room temperature or hot. Serve it in little squares.
Mm-hmm.
Just take a pizza cutter and go bum, 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 bum. Set it out. Everybody eats it with their fingers.
Oh, that sounds great.
So that's,
I think that's those fresh ingredients is what really makes it.
Yeah, exactly. And what happens is, you know, the greens crisp, the cheese gets a bit gooey, but you don't want to overload it. This is very spare. But it's easy to handle. It tastes fabulous, and you serve it in little squares.
Mm-hmm. Just normal pie crust.
Normal pie crust. Mm-hmm. Normal pie crust. And you'll have a blast.
Okay. Well, I can handle that.
Well, okay. Hey, Sandy, thanks for a great question.
Well, thanks. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Bye.
Call us, 800-537-5252, or go to splendidtable.org and send us an email. We've got an email from Diane in Portland, Oregon. Now, she said, I used to buy and make generous use of the herb called savory. It worked well with everything, vegetables, cheese, eggs, meat. Now I can't find it anywhere. Did I hallucinate all that savory? Is savory really a blend like curry? What happened to savory? Well, Diane, I think savory has fallen out of favor. Now, if you have one of those stores that has fresh herbs of every sort, you'll probably find it. But it's easy to grow. There are two kinds. Winter, which is a perennial. It'll come back every year. It's really hardy. It's a low-growing little bushlet. And then there's summer savory, which is an annual, and you plant it in the summer. I'd grow the winter. Savory tastes as though thyme got married to a little mint, a little black pepper, and a celery leaf was their sin child. And it's, you're right, it is delicious with just about everything from salmon to, it's really, by the way, wonderful with dried beans, cooked dried beans or grains. So keep your eye out at farmers markets because you'll probably see it through the summer. And you didn't hallucinate. It really exists. Call us 800-537-5252. We have got Brian calling from Atlanta, Georgia. Brian, what do you want to talk about?
Well, as I was opening a can of Guinness the other day, I noticed that the company was established in 1759, and it seemed like a wonderful excuse for a party, 250th anniversary. And it so happens that after looking at that, recipe for a Guinness pie, I think modified from a Jamie Oliver recipe, appeared
right,
in
right.
the New York Times.
The British chef, yeah.
Yeah, appeared in the New York Times magazine. So I'm all set with that. But now I really need particularly a dessert, if possible, and some, you know, appetizers perhaps. Or...
Ooh, okay, now let's think for a minute. Just from your accent, I realize you've probably experienced Guinness on its home territory.
Oh, yes. I brought up with this peculiar sign, Guinness is good for you, and I wondered what Guinness was.
found out, I would imagine.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
They used to prescribe it for pregnant women.
Well, you know, it's beer, and beer has been called liquid bread.
Yeah.
And for the longest time, and you know, who knows? It certainly would have with all those yeasts and whatever could be quite helpful. But rather than going in that direction, let's get more hedonistic about it. Okay, if we break down, what does Guinness taste like? It's very dark, it's bitter, if I remember, and it's kind of toasty, right?
Right.
Okay. So when you have bitter and you have toasty, I think of, if we're thinking dessert, okay, you want really robust, spicy things. Like, for instance, you want something that is either chocolate or gingerbread. Okay, so I would, first of all, I would bet you any amount of money there are recipes for Guinness gingerbread where Guinness is actually in the recipe. Okay.
That sounds like a wonderful combination.
Yeah, I think it would be fabulous. And the other thing is, I'm just thinking there's probably Guinness chocolate cakes because bittersweet chocolate with Guinness, that would be a wonderful combination, you know. But I'm just wondering what would happen if you took a basic brownie recipe and tossed a little Guinness in there. I mean, a bittersweet with a lot of chocolate, chunks of chocolate in it as well. I mean, a little Guinness in there would just be a nice accent. And the other thing, I've never tried this, but it comes to mind. What would happen if you tried to make a Guinness syrup that you could put over something very rich and creamy like vanilla ice cream, a really good vanilla ice cream? Boil down the Guinness with fresh ginger and brown sugar. This may be a disaster, but if you do a little bit of this, just do it with the brown sugar. Don't waste any fresh ginger yet. Do it with a little bit of it and see if you get something. Because what I'm imagining is you're going to get something with a nice sharp edge, but the caramelly quality of the brown sugar and then the sparkle of that fresh ginger. I think that could make a great syrup. And that could go over fruit, but I'm thinking especially something very rich and creamy like vanilla ice cream.
Sure.
So see, give it a shot, as we say.
Okay.
And you know, the other thing, which we did when we lived in Belgium for a period of time, and you know, Belgium has, what, 300 some odd beers. And some of the beers were very fruity, had edges of sweetness, but also had the toastiness of the Guinness and a tartness or the bitterness of the Guinness. And I used to roast carrots in them. Mm. I would toss them, you know, I'd cut up carrots, toss them with some olive oil and then the beer. Mm. And I would roast that. Not a lot of the beer, but I'd kind of baste the carrots, so I wanted everything to get glazed. Or I would cook the carrots in the beer with butter and garlic and then a little bit of brown sugar. And then you'd boil that with some you know, usually no water, just the beer, and then boil it down to a glaze so the carrots were syrupy. It was not a bad thing. The sweet carrots, you know, you could do it with squash. But for dessert, gingerbread or try the syrup.
Okay.
And happy birthday to Guinness.
Hey, and the top of the morning to you, Lynn.
Thank you, sir. You and to you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Yeah, there's nothing wrong. Any excuse for a party, call us. 800-537-5252. Anything goes. So you're knocking yourself out to reduce your carbon footprint to a mere toe tap. You're recycling everything but the cat, composting half of supper every night. But there's a hulking eco-sinner in the room that you're probably totally ignoring. It's the refrigerator. Rachel Mustin and a lot of other people believe the fridge is the biggest energy drain we've got. So Rachel did something about it. I've got Rachel Mustin on the phone. Rachel, welcome.
Hi, nice to be here.
So tell us what you did.
Well, as well as doing a lot of those things that you mentioned, like composting, we just decided that it might be an interesting experiment to try going without a fridge. So when we came back from a vacation, probably about a year and a half ago, the fridge was almost empty at that point because we cleared it out, and so we just unplugged it. And we haven't really looked back.
So how do you deal with not having a refrigerator?
Well, we do keep a cooler, which we use to store dairy and some vegetables. And we keep that cold with ice we make outside in the winter. I live in Ottawa, and it gets really cold here in the wintertime. So we make ice outside. And in the summertime, we make ice in our chest freezer, which we keep in the basement.
So the chest freezer is probably also storing a lot of food for you.
Yeah, it is. As part of our carbon footprint reduction, we're trying to eat as locally as possible. So we preserve a lot of food and store it in the freezer.
So how much money have you saved?
Well, that's something that's a little bit hard to measure in terms of specifically how much have we saved from the refrigerator.
Right.
Because we've done so many things at once, like we completely stopped using the dryer and turned down our electric heat, which we have on one floor of the house. And so it's a little bit hard to measure in terms of dollars. But for the electricity, but we're definitely saving a good portion. The fridge that we had was probably about 20 years old, so it was really, really inefficient, and we think it was using something like 1,200 kilowatt hours a year, which is, compared to the fridges you could buy now, that's a huge, huge energy hog.
Well, what do you miss the most from that refrigerator?
What do we miss the most? Well, my husband would say he would miss access to plenty of cold beer whenever he wanted.
But that may be the reason for another cooler, right?
Well, that's it, yeah. Or we're lucky we've got a couple pubs within walking distance, so we can always go there if we need to. There's really not a lot that we miss. For me, probably, it's not so much the fridge, but having a freezer readily accessible. Our freezer is all the way down in the basement, which we have to go outside to get to. So if we need anything for the freezer, it's a bit of a hassle.
Yeah,
and it was
nice
having the freezer in the kitchen to get out any of our frozen vegetables.
Are you using that refrigerator for anything?
No, and actually, we just had it taken away to be recycled last weekend. We did have it sitting empty in the kitchen for the longest time, and we thought about using it for storage, but it was just old and not very nice. So there's a great program here in Ontario where they take them away to be fully recycled. So we had that done just this last weekend.
And now you've got more counter space if you choose, right?
I know, exactly. The kitchen looks huge.
Yeah, I'm just thinking what my kitchen would look like without the fridge. Interesting to contemplate.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I have a friend who plays the guitar who lives near us, and so he said that if we put a chair in there, he'll come up and play his guitar in the kitchen. I think that's pretty good.
Hey, Rachel, thanks for talking with us.
No problem. Thank you.
You take care.
You too.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Rachel Mustin works in information technology for the Canadian government in Ottawa. Now, for more information, check out the article written by Stephen Kuritz, in the February 4th, 2009 issue of the New York Times. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Have a great week. And until next time, let me leave you with this thought from Fran Lebowitz, who said, "Cold soup is a very tricky thing. More often than not, the dinner guest is left with the impression that had he only come a little earlier, he would have gotten it while it was still hot." Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and supported by the Poetry Foundation. In support of poetry on American Public Media programs. More information online at poetryfoundation.org. Now you'll find information on almost everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org. And, well, hold on, there's a lot more on that website. Not only will you find newsletters and podcasts, you can sign up for our Gastrosexual of the Month competition, get information on our book, How to Eat Supper, and find a collection of inexpensive recipes to get you cooking in your kitchen. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Andrew Schumacher and Judy Boudreau. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Brett Baldwin. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.